Interview with Roger Revelle.
Time we can try another time.
As long as the little light is going, you're on.
Okay. Well, I think I can best answer what you're interested in by trying to do it in historical terms. The Scripps Institution of Oceanography was started a very long time ago in 1903. It became part of the university in 1912, but it was pretty much of a neglected stepsister of the university until after World War II. Although we had a very marked change when we got a new director in 1936 named Harold Sverdrup.
How do you spell his name?
Sverdrup. First name Harold. Harald. Not O-L-D.
Swedish? Norwegian?
Norwegian.
Norwegian.
He was one of the world's greatest oceanographers. And for the first time, Scripps became a really professional place under his leadership. Before that, the oceanography was mostly pretty amateurish. Although we had a couple quite able and imaginative directors. I was a graduate student at Scripps and got my PhD in 1936, just the year that Harold Sverdrup came there. And then I became an instructor on the faculty. And 1941, I went on active duty in the Navy, summer 41. And it turned out that the Navy all of a sudden got interested in oceanography for a variety of reasons, and I was sort of the principal. Unofficially, the Navy's oceanographer. And I did a great many different things with the Navy and in the Navy, including organizing a oceanographic survey and resurvey of Bikini Atoll. And I came back here in 1948 as the associate director of the institution. In 1950, became acting director, and then 51, director. Mm-hmm. And I was director. But again, director of Scripps until 1964. We had, by this time, the Scripps Institution was quite a big and prominent place, probably the leading oceanographic institution in the world, or at least one of them. Two or three leaders. And we had quite a few graduate students. By this time, we'd become part of the Southern Section of the Academic Senate, or it was called the Southern Section of the Academic Senate, which was headquartered at UCLA. And we had always in our doctoral examinations for our graduate students, we had at least two members of the UCLA faculty. It turned out that they didn't know much about oceanography, but they knew a lot about physics and chemistry and the earth sciences and biology. Our students weren't very well prepared because they'd come down here as fresh-caught graduates. They learned a lot about oceanography, but not much about the basic sciences. So I thought that we ought to try to start a graduate school of science and engineering here in La Jolla. This was strongly backed by the powers that be in San Diego, for the basic reason that that there were quite a few technical industries here by that time, particularly Convair, but several others too, Aurora Aircraft and Solar Aircraft, Ryan, and new ones like Cave, like Cubic Corporation, Coton Corporation. Made presentations to the regents, to the Central University Administration. And by 1957, the regents had agreed to start a school, a graduate school of science and engineering here in La Jolla.
Do you have any problems with the regents?
Not at all. I was kind of the darling of the regents at that time.
Yeah.
Because they were ready. I was rather eloquent about oceanography.
Yeah.
And their imaginations were fascinated by the Pacific Ocean right outside their door.
Right.
And we got the city of San Diego the people of the city of San Diego to vote to allocate 50 acres of what are called Pueblo lands of the city of San Diego to
public. Pueblo is public?
Pueblo is a... San Diego is an old Spanish pueblo.
I see.
Pueblo means city.
City, I see.
It had a big grant of land from the King of Spain.
Okay.
Of course, he just assumed that he owned it. He took it from the Indians. Those pueblo lands still exist. They're still part of the heritage of the city of San Diego.
I see.
And they voted to give the university 50 acres for this new school of science and engineering. And I was made the dean of it. And what was called by that time chief campus officer, that is, I was director of Scripps and dean of the school of graduate school of engineering, which of course didn't exist. And therefore chief campus officer of this campus.
Up to you to create it.
Just about that time, there was a report of something called the California Commission on Higher Education. And which was based on demographic projections that California would have 50 million people by the year 2000. And this commission strongly recommended the creation of three new campuses by the University of California. Three new major general campuses. And that completely took the wind out of the Graduate School of Science and Engineering with my acquiescence and concurrence. Much more interesting to start a whole university than to start a Graduate School of Science and Engineering. So, they gradually agreed to do this, and the real question was where to put it. And there were lots of different opinions about that. My opinion was it ought to be right here where it is, right next to the Scripps Institution. And the reason I thought so, not only was it a nice, good site, a beautiful site, but Scripps was, by this time, had a good international reputation, so that it gave a sort of sense of reality to the place. And particularly it gave a sense of reality when we persuaded Harold Urey to come here.
Yeah.
Harold Urey, the Nobel Prize winning chemist. He joined the faculty of Scripps.
Was that your doing?
Oh yes, sure. I recruited all these guys. But he was the first one. It was easy, it was a cinch, because the area around Chicago had become very dangerous. The Hyde Park area.
Yeah.
So he and his wife were scared to walk out at night, go out at night. So they were delighted to come here.
Uh-huh.
And after a while, that's another story. But later, when we started the university, several other Chicago people came. And the regents and the university administration conducted a search for a site here in San Diego. They decided that they wanted to have a campus somewhere in San Diego County. The question was where. They were not quite so convinced about where the other two campuses should be, but they were strongly influenced there by people who gave them land. And both in Santa Cruz and in Irvine, they got large grants of land. Here, there were many different possibilities. And I pushed very hard for this particular site right here. The principal opposition came from a region named Ed Pauley. Yeah. He didn't really want a campus here at all. In fact, he didn't want any new campuses. What he wanted was to have both UCLA and Berkeley continue to expand in size, like sort of like the University of Minnesota, with 50,000 students. And he couldn't really directly oppose the new campuses, so what he did was to suggest various alternatives, like putting this campus in Balboa Park. People of San Diego weren't very sure whether they wanted a university at all, but they knew goddamn well they didn't want Balboa Park. And his argument for not having it here was airplane noise, aircraft noise, from Miramar to the east. And we spent literally months working on this problem. We got the Miramar people to change their flight pattern. We made measurements of the actual noise levels over the campus. But of course, since this was a fake issue anyhow, it didn't matter what we did. And finally there was a regents meeting in Davis in which Charles Luckman, the surviving member of the firm of Pereira and Luckman, said that to build a campus here would cost at least $20 million more because of noise protection, because of the noise problem. How long do you live in this area?
No, I was in San Diego in 1915 as a boy of 10 when Rogers had just flown across the country, and then fell into the ocean here. And I remember seeing them at night bringing his body in.
That was the time of the World's Fair.
Yes, right.
Well, anyhow, there is a hostel here east of here, about 3 miles closer to Miramar than we are, and just in the flight pattern. And this fellow Luckman, this guy was charged with recommending locating for the campus, had sent a letter to the administrator of the hospital, which was at that time in downtown La Jolla, saying there would be no noise problem here in Miramar at all. For the hospital, in spite of the fact it was 3 miles closer to Miramar and right in the flight path. And I was a friend of his administrator, so I got hold of the letter. And I gave it to Clark Kerr, who was the president at that time. And after Luckman had made his presentation, Clark got up and read this letter. And Paul said, "Who wrote that letter?" Luckman said, "I did, sir." Within about 5 minutes, the Regents had voted 23-1 to put the campus here, provided that they got 1,000 acres of land free and an agreement from the city to plan a university, jointly plan a university community. We then put on the ballot in San Diego a gift of 500 acres of Pueblo land. And we asked the Navy, which wanted to move. This place where we're sitting at right now is called Camp Matthews. It's my associate director was an admiral named Charles Wheelock, and he was very well thought of in the Navy. And a wonderful man. And between us, we managed to get the Navy to agree to get this land to the university. So between this boat up for the 500 acres and the Navy, we got the 1,000 acres that the Bishop stipulated. Yeah. Well, this was fine. The problem then, of course, was to start the university in the right direction. And my opinion was that the main problem was to get a good faculty, an outstanding faculty. Everything else would follow from that. I read a book by a man named Reichstam on the history of European universities.
Yes, uh-huh.
You perhaps know that.
I know it.
And I also studied the career of William Rainey Harper, the first president of the University of Chicago. That's a fascinating story, by the way.
I know.
Harper was approached early on by Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, to start a college somewhere in the Middle West. Harper was a professor of Hebrew, and he spent lots of time teaching Hebrew at Chautauqua summer camps
in New York.
Harper said, "I don't want to start a college. I want to start a university. Now, what shall that cost? At least $25 million, Mr. Rockefeller. I'm sorry, we can't do that." This went on for years. Bob Rockefeller pestering Harper, and Harper saying, "No, I got to start a university." Finally, Rockefeller got into the hands of a man named Gates, who was a minister, a Methodist Baptist minister, who was quite an imaginative, even far-sighted guy. He said, "You just got to let this fellow Harper have what he wants." And so they did. So that the day it opened its doors, the University of Chicago was a first-rate university. And his essential tactic was to recruit an outstanding faculty.
Yeah.
In his case, he did it with money. Mm-hmm. Offered people twice what they were getting where they were. Mm-hmm. He ruined Clark University in Worcester, Mass. by stealing all their good people. So that's a very interesting story. But we couldn't really do that because the state had limitations on salaries. And besides, I didn't think it was a good idea. I thought that if you could buy people, if you got other people, then buy them away. So we basically had to appeal to people, to the imagination and the desires, or non-physical desires of faculty members. And in general, our policy was never to pay people more than they were getting where they were.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had at least two things going for you, probably three. The location. The goal of what the institution was going to become, and the leaders who were already there, including yourself.
That's right, exactly. what we actually had was a team of people, the principal members of which were a physicist named Keith Bruckner, a chemist named Jim Arnold, and a biologist named David Bonner, and myself. And Carl Eckhart was a prominent University of Chicago physicist, and a great man, and as an enthusiastic scripture, well, I won't say enthusiastic, but some partially enthusiastic Scripps faculty.
Yeah.
Some of the people were enthusiastic about Scripps. Others were very unhappy about it. And what we decided to do, and what we did, in fact, was to start with a graduate school. This, I think, was the key academic decision. The first few years, we took only graduate students and emphasized research and built one department at a time. First physics, then chemistry, about three really, physics, chemistry, and biology.
Right.
Of course, we had a stronger sciences group at Scripps. not in classical geology, but in geophysics and geochemistry. And of course, meteorology and oceanography. But then we tried to invent some new things that appealed to people. One of them was our college system. The way I thought of it, obviously it didn't work out that way, but I thought that these would be the little universities side by side, each with about 2,500 students, and with both graduates and undergraduates. And that would be the primary organizing unit of the university.
What has happened? You've got five colleges now.
Yes, yeah, but they're not really little universities.
Yeah.
They're just really devices for giving us to the undergraduates a sense of identity.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And they do pretty well at that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a far cry from the original concept.
Yeah. Right.
Anyhow, at that time we thought it was possible. Clark Kerr thought it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
Our new faculty members thought it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
I thought of them as like little Princetons,
mm-hmm.
which at that time had about 2,500 students, mm-hmm. 500 graduates, and 2,000 undergraduates.
Westland in Connecticut, which is my alma mater, has a college system based on the disciplines, on certain of the disciplines.
Yes.
But it's undergraduate.
Well, that was more typical of the American universities.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Berkeley had a college of chemistry and a college of engineering. But what I thought of these, each college would have enough faculty, 200 faculty, to give a liberal education in humanities, social sciences, and natural sciences. Excuse me, I just got to go to the bathroom. So the way that we started, we think of these little universities, the way it worked out, as I said, they're primarily undergraduates.
Yeah.
The departments are you just couldn't get away in America from
departments.
From departments.
No.
Although lots of people at that time thought you could, including McGeorge Bundy of Harvard.
Yeah.
So another of our ideas was, this turned out not to be very good either. Like a lot of people thought it was good at the time, was to have the art departments really be practitioners rather than scholars and historians.
Performance in the case of music.
Both performance and composition.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In the same way with the visual arts.
Right.
We have three of these arts departments: music, visual arts, and drama.
Right.
The drama works very well, mm-hmm. particularly because it works closely with the La Jolla Playhouse, which is a professional group. The music department is so avant-garde that most people can't stand what they do.
Well, way beyond their audience.
And that's true of the visual arts, too.
Yes.
The music department is quite, I think, quite well recognized nationally, but it can be internationally, but certainly not locally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And neither is the visual. And the visual arts department just really isn't very good. In my perhaps amateurish belief. Another of our ideas was that we wanted to emphasize research. That this was would contain to be a research university.
Research across the board.
That's right.
Not only the science, not simply the sciences.
That's right. But it was very much harder in the humanities and the social sciences because we didn't have a library.
Yes.
That's why we started with the sciences, with the natural sciences. Because they don't need much of a library. We managed to get a first-rate librarian. This is perhaps the most important appointment we made, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Although most people wouldn't agree with it. We might not agree with that. A man named Mel Boyd. He had a brilliant idea.
B-O-I-D?
V-O-I-G-H-T. V-O-I-G-T, Voigt.
D-O-I-G-T.
He had been a librarian at the University of Kansas. His idea was to build three undergraduate libraries at the same time, one for UC, one for us, one for Irvine, and one for Santa Cruz, of 75,000 volumes each. They were exact duplicates of each other. It saved about $500,000 to do it this way because of the accessioning and cataloging costs very much less. And this impressed the regents. The regents and the university administration agreed to get. The result was, for the next 10 years, he had pretty much his own way about building up the library.
Good.
And we did pretty well. We have. It's not by any means a great library, but it's a good one. They have about 2,000 volumes now. 2 million volumes.
2 million volumes.
Nothing like that.
I was impressed with your computerization of searching material.
Yes, it's very good, I think. Although I think it's pretty much general in libraries. But compared to the Harvard Library, this one is a very much more satisfactory library. The Widener Library is about five times as big.
I know Widener.
It's about five times as hard to get a book out of.
Yeah.
Maybe, in fact, it's virtually impossible to get a book out of. Everybody.
My PhD is from Harvard.
I don't think anybody at Harvard thinks well of the Widener Library, except maybe the librarians. But our library, on the other hand, Mel created this tradition of service, of helping people. He thought the library was a tool to be used, not a collection to be prized.
Yeah.
And they still have that tradition.
That's good.
And the result is just wonderful.
It's good.
A place to get help from. And so they built up the social sciences and to some extent the humanities as best they could with this library build-up. But of course, building a library just gets harder and harder all the time.
Cost is terrific.
And so they're still not awfully good.
How about your funding? Did you get good financial support from the state? Or where does it come from?
Well, it comes largely from the federal government because of our research. Well, maybe that isn't so. The budget now is, I think, about $450 million a year.
$450?
I think so. You could get that figure from the chancellor's office. I'm going to the chancellor's office in a few minutes, and I'll have them. But of that amount, I think about half comes from the state and half from the federal government and from private donations and various countries. The Scripps itself gets about $60 million a year. The medical school gets another 50 or 60. The rest about 40 or 50, I think. Research funds. We now have about 16,000 students. Not anywhere enough. We thought initially that we'd have two-thirds undergraduates and one-third graduates. We actually have about 85% undergraduates and 15% graduates. And that's because we don't have many professional schools. We just started a new one called the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies. This is going great guns. We're just about to start a school of architecture. This will help some too. And I would like to see a couple of more professional schools. One of government.
Yes.
Perhaps one of public health or social welfare or something like that. funding from the state depends an awful lot on the governor.
Certainly does. We know that.
In our case, we had 16 years of governors who were very bad for the university. First Ronald Reagan for 8 years, and Jerry Brown for 8 years. On the opposite ends of the political spectrum.
Yeah.
Reagan thought the university was too full of communists. Meaning his far as Democrats. Essentially indistinguishable from his point of view.
Yeah.
Jerry Brown thought it was an elitist institution. So he started to. The first governor for a long time has been kind to the university is Duke Majin, our present governor. And the result is we've had an orgy of building in the last 3 or 4 years.
I've been seeing that, yes.
That's fantastic.
Right.
And the salaries have now gone up to the so that the faculty salaries are comparable to the Eastern University, the University of California likes to compare itself with.
Okay.
Including Harvard, Michigan,
right.
Cornell, Virginia.
Very good. Very good.
What else can I say about it? But as I say, the first thing we started with the science, which we were strong,
right.
And started with graduate work, which would attract good research faculty.
How were you able to get the quality of leadership and the quality of faculty that you have?
Well, basically by talking to them. And filling them, giving them a vision of what the university could be like.
Yes.
And of course, it's a very nice place.
Yes. Right.
San Diego is not a very, well, was not a very civilized town, but it's getting somewhat more so. Our sympathy has gradually been getting back to first rate stages. I think the main thing was the existence of the Scripps Institution here, which gave the place a sense of reality.
Yeah.
And also quite sophisticated people.
Yes, right.
And second was his emphasis on graduates, graduate work right from at the beginning.
In terms of the regents, were they graduates of private institutions?
You mean the University of California?
Yes, or the state system?
No, they're all kinds of, come from all kinds of backgrounds.
Are they appointed by the governor?
Yes, they're all appointed. No, I'm sorry, that's not quite right. In my day, there were 24 regents. Mm-hmm. I think there are maybe 26 or 27 now. Whom 16 were appointed and 8 were ex officio. 8 of the ex officio ones were the governor, the lieutenant governor, the speaker of the assembly, the superintendent of public instruction, the head of the agricultural, the board of agriculture, the president of the alumni association, and the president of something called the Mechanics Institute of San Francisco, which was a hangover from the gold rush days.
I see.
Those were the 8 appointed regents. I mean, 8 ex officio.
Ex officio.
Yeah, but the essential thing about the regents was that they had 16-year terms.
16?
That's right. And a provision in the state constitution, which said that the legislature should have no control over the university except to maintain the integrity of its funds, in other words, to audit the university's books.
That's in the Constitution.
That's our fundamental constitutional prerogative. As a matter of fact, it doesn't work very well because it's quite right that the university's entire budget is just one line in the state budget. University of California, $2.5 billion, something like that. But that the university passes the legislature passes resolutions, which the state, the university pays quite a bit of attention to, particularly in terms of building, in terms of such fundamental things as support of graduate students. In general, the legislature thinks they have an obligation to educate people up to the BA degree, the BA level, but not beyond it. So it's much harder to get support for graduate students than it's for undergraduate. But there is quite a bit of
Excuse me, we're starting the search committee for the dean of the School of Architecture.
Where is it?
It's right in the political science conference room, right here in this building.
I'll be there in just a minute.
Fine, thank you.
It still has some validity. This, the Regents terms have now been cut to 12 years.
I see. Mm-hmm.
It's still pretty good. But the interesting and essential thing about it is they all get co-opted by the university.
Mm-hmm. I see.
In other words, by the time they're halfway through their terms, they really believe in the University of California.
Yeah.
And it is a wonderful institution. Greatest, I think it's Berkeley particularly is the greatest university in the world. Mm-hmm. We're nowhere near in that category yet, but we're only 25 years old.
Yes. Berkeley is what, 100 years old at least?
It started about 1855.
125
years old. Well, it didn't amount to very much until a man named Benjamin I. Wheeler became the president of the early 1900s.
But it's provided a model for you, for the other institutions.
Sure have. A model of excellence.
Yeah.
And of course, one of the things that makes an awful lot of difference is our admission standards. We admit only the top 12.5% of high school graduates.
I see.
Unlike the Middle Western universities that admit almost everybody,
yeah,
but flunk them out. We don't flunk out anybody from Pelham.
Yeah.
We want them all to graduate.
Well, thanks ever so much.
I hope I've answered some of your questions.
I think you have.
And I'll be very glad to talk to you again.
Very nice to see you.
Good luck.
I don't know whether you know Crane Brinton.
Yes, I do.
Good.
Sure.
I was his second PhD.
Well, were you? Because I was at Harvard.
Yes.
His son, Ed Brinton, is the faculty member here.
Is that right?
Scripps.
You got it.
See you later.
All right. I would like to ask you, what do you look for in selecting individuals? Because you did a marvelous job here.
Well, I don't know whether I told you this yesterday, but we decided to start from the top down, to build a roof first.
Yes.
To get the professors first.
Yes.
And to start with graduate studies.
Where did you look for them?
We looked for them in other universities, of course.
Yes.
And also in government labs, or in research laboratories. Mm-hmm. We got quite a few of our physicists from the Bell Labs.
From Bell Labs, I see.
That was kind of interesting because I told you my policy was not to pay people anything more than they were getting where they were.
Yes. Right.
But that was, I was just completely mistaken about that as far as the Bell Labs were concerned, because here they got 9 months appointments, mm-hmm, and they could spend 3 months in the summertime doubling their incomes.
Yeah.
Whereas the Bell Labs, they just got a year-round appointment and couldn't do any consulting.
Yeah.
So in fact, all our Bell Labs people did very well financially by coming here from the Bell Labs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, actually, what we did was to, or what I did was to depend on these three people I told you about, David Bonner, Jim Arnold, and Keith Bruckner, physicist, chemist, and biologist, and they pretty much found the people.
I see. Did you bring those three in?
Yes.
Bring those three. David Bonner, I wonder if by any chance he has a brother, Francis Bonner.
No, he has a brother, James Bonner.
James Bonner.
At Caltech.
At Caltech.
Another brother, Bonner, Tom Bonner.
I see.
I don't think there's a Francis Bonner, though.
Because Francis was at Yale, and he's a former chairman of our chemistry department.
Yes.
Built that.
But yeah, David was at Yale, too.
I see.
In biology.
I see. Okay.
And what we looked for was people who are not really senior scientists, but people who are coming up.
Mm-hmm.
The only members of the National Academy that we recruited here were Harold Urey. I told you about him, getting him early, and then later Joseph Mayer and his wife, mm-hmm. Maria Mayer.
Mm-hmm.
After she came here, won the Nobel Prize,
mm-hmm.
but not for work that she did here.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Joe Mayer was a great chemist, mm-hmm. one of the leading chemists in the country. But except for those three, I don't think any of the other people that we brought here were members of the Academy when they came.
I see.
But a lot of them became members after they came.
You have to be able to spot talent.
That's right. And I don't quite know how he did this. He just did it. But one thing, of course, was the main problem was to persuade him to come.
Yes.
And I used to spend most of my time talking to people,
mm-hmm.
telling what a great place it was going to be.
Yes.
Sometimes it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
This area just west of here used to be something called Camp Callan.
Yeah.
It was an army camp.
Army camp.
And there were lots of sort of ruins of the army camp still there. One of them was a fallen chimney.
Mm-hmm.
It was right at the high point of the mesa,
mm-hmm.
on an old beach ridge. And I used to go up on top of this fallen chimney and take my prospective candidate, or my prospects up there, and say, can't you see the campus all around here? Some of them could see it, some of them couldn't.
Yeah.
The ones that couldn't, didn't come.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the ones that didn't come was a very great man, Chandra Sekhar, the great astrophysicist.
How do you spell his name?
Chandrasekhar. Chandra Sekhar.
Oh, Chandra, Indian.
Indian, yeah.
Yes, I see.
The Nobel Prize winner. Mm-hmm. Later, one of the great scientists of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
But he was at Chicago. He wanted to stay at Chicago.
Yeah.
Or actually, he was at the McDonald Observatory, which is Chicago's, University of Chicago's astronomical observatory.
McDonald. I knew Bent Stromgren.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Bent Stromgren,
yeah.
who was director of Yerkes.
Yes.
And also of McDonald. Then went to had Einstein's study at Princeton.
Yes.
The Institute. And went back to Copenhagen.
I never knew him.
Yeah.
He's an astronomer.
Astronomer, right. Yeah.
And several other people we didn't get.
Yes.
I particularly remember Chandra Sekhar.
Uh-huh.
Because
but you were after him. Okay.
But what you have to have is a feeling for, I guess, a feeling for imaginative and bright people.
Right. Well, you know, William James saying that the value of a liberal education is that it enables you to tell a good man when you see him.
Yes, is that right? I never heard that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What role did Berkeley play in the development of the state system? See, New York State did not have a Berkeley.
That's right.
And
makes a lot of difference.
Makes a lot of difference. What difference did it make here?
Well, it had several effects. One was that Berkeley was far enough away so they weren't jealous of Lafayette. Uh-huh. Whereas UCLA thought it took a very good view of,
I think,
of having a big campus, like a first-rate campus here. The UCLA people thought we should be a sort of a feeder campus for UCLA, mm-hmm. teaching undergraduates, mm-hmm. sort of the junior college, adjunct to UCLA. And the Berkeley people were not all of the same mind, but fortunately some of them, particularly Glenn Seaborg,
mm-hmm. oh, yes.
who I knew very well. And I've been their director of scripts for many years.